Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll talk to Assemblymember Mia Bonta and journalist Sarah Varney about the future of reproductive access here in California under a new Trump administration. And Yolanda Renee King, granddaughter of Martin Luther King, joins us to discuss how King honors her family's legacy and why teens are vital to any political movement. But first, the crisis created by the acute lack of housing dominates Bay Area headlines. Case in point, in 2024, San Francisco produced only 1,205 units of housing, well below the number needed to make the goal of 82,000 new units of housing by 2031. But there are solutions to this problem. San Francisco Chronicle reporter Aldo Toledo followed one family in the Mission who went from renters worried about eviction to potential homeownership. He joins us tonight to share that story. Welcome to State of the Bay, Aldo.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted. This is like a happy story to end our year on when it comes to housing. In your story, you covered Sandra Martinez and Luis Zeron. Hopefully I said that right. They are tenants of a one-bedroom apartment in the Mission, and they were worried about being evicted. First, tell me a little bit about the couple.
Yeah, I mean, so Sandra works at McDonald's and Luis works at a bakery, and they, you know, kind of scrounge their money together to make it by here in the Bay with their two kids. And one bedroom is kind of not correct. So they have like a junior one bedroom. It's one of these, you know, kind of studios with an alcove. So everything's open, and they've set up two bunk beds in the living room, like right next to the kitchen, where their two children sleep. So, you know, they're kind of living in a cramped environment, these two.
Certainly tight quarters. And Martinez and Zeron were quite worried about being evicted. Why?
Well, I mean, during the pandemic, they weren't able to get work. And like a lot of other people, they started getting a debt when it came to back rent, and they had a lot of money that they owed. They ended up getting some support and getting about $12,000 of a $30,000 debt taken care of, but there was this still, you know, thing looming over them. But you know, kind of separately to that, there was also a lot going on in the building itself. They inherited like a pretty damp and moldy apartment that they had to do some repairs to. But there's also a lot of kind of violations associated with the landlord. They had two notices of violation, one including like a seismic retrofit they really needed to do. So, you know, they really started to kind of talk to people about these things in their building.
And what do we know about the landlord they had at the time?
Yeah, so this is was at one point San Francisco's biggest landlord. They owned the most, biggest residential landlord. But they recently defaulted on a portfolio of about 23 buildings, which included 320 14th Street. And so that's about 762 rent-controlled apartments in all. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a notorious landlord. They took $3.6 million in PPP loans and then defaulted on this $1 billion portfolio. And they were associated too with the closure of the Hates Club Deluxe. Mm-hmm. And like I said, they never did these seismic retrofits in several buildings, including the one where Sandra and Luis live.
Yeah. And the landlord we're talking about is the company Veritas, right?
Veritas, yeah.
Right. So I understand. I mean, these are not optimal conditions for two people, let alone a family of four. I mean, these two children as well. So I understand the couple began organizing with other renters in the building. What were they asking for from the landlord just to fix these problems? And were they able to get that done?
Yeah. So, I mean, they kind of worked with what they had, which was kind of like each other in a way. So, you know, Sandra started really like knocking on doors in her building and finding out that a lot of them had similar issues in terms of repairs, but then also a lot of like the back rent issues as well. And they thought that maybe, you know, going together and kind of striking a deal with Veritas might work, or, you know, kind of bring up their concerns about the state of the building. But Veritas refused to kind of do these things, which kind of began to escalate the situation.
And then we have the hero of the story. I mean, besides the tenants themselves, who I think took, the situation in their own hands. But we've got the San Francisco Community Land Trust coming in. Tell us a little bit about that organization, what it does, and who's behind it.
So the Land Trust is a nonprofit, and basically their mission is to create permanently affordable housing for low to moderate income people through the community ownership of land. So they actually help tenants form housing cooperatives in certain buildings. They acquire buildings, but they maintain ownership over the land while the tenants can own the units. And it's funded through a different a lot of different things. Mostly it's city money and state money, a lot of it through the Small Sites program, a lot of crowdfunding, donations. One donation in particular is really interesting. And in 2023, Mackenzie Scott, who's the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos, donated $20 million to the Land Trust to help to expand its portfolio and maybe start like new land trusts in other places.
Well, way to go, Mackenzie. I mean, that seems like a good way to spend your money. So the land trust itself did ended up buying this the land underneath this apartment. Is that right?
Yeah, basically. So, the land trust is basically expanding, or trying to expand as much as it can with the limited funds that it has. Tied to, a lot of it is tied to public investment, and every transaction is kind of unique. In this case, it was a building that already was organized, and people actually, as part of the negotiations with the landlord, they wanted the land trust to actually acquire the building. So they became, kind of aware of it through the Housing Rights Committee, which is a kind of organization that helps tenants organize unions in their buildings. And they were finally able to, get what they wanted, that early Christmas present, as you kind of alluded to earlier.
Yeah, and so when the you spoke to the land trust, and when the trust decides to buy a piece of property and add it to their portfolio, I mean, they really are looking for buildings where the tenants are organized or active together or kind of banded together in this process, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of kind of, seeing which specific sites make the most sense, and places where they know that people want them already. I mean, they can kind of go negotiate with the landlord there, especially when you have a buyer that is really willing to look at the land trust as a, or a seller rather, looking to the land trust as a buyer.
Is it, and so the way this works then, will the tenants be paying the land trust in rent? And is the land trust in charge of making sure the building is up to spec, or is it up to the tenants?
No, so it is the land trust and the tenants themselves. So all of the money that they pay to the land trust will be used to then maintain and do some of these repairs that have been so neglected over the years in this building. I mean, I think that Sander and Luis, for example, are, because of the heavy rent burden that they had, are actually going to get a discount as part of this deal. So they're going to pay something like 15% less in their rent, because they were one of the most cost burdened households in the building. This is a building of like majority Spanish speaking, long time residents. The kind of people that were displaced during the last 10 years or so, during the tech boom especially. So these are long time residents that are now, gonna either pay rent to the land trust or start the process of potentially getting ownership through a long-term lease with them.
This is such an encouraging idea, and I wonder, is it a replicable model? I mean, is this a cost-effective way to help people stay housed?
The land trust believes that this is a very cost-effective way to have to deal with the affordable housing crisis. We have a general housing crisis, but we also have a crisis of affordable housing. And they say that their plans usually average something like $250,000 a door, is what they said. And that's pretty low compared to some of the other ways that the city has tried to do affordable housing, either through 100% affordable projects or inclusionary. And also it's like only replicable if there's enough money given to it for acquisition. So recently there was $64 million that the land trust got after a bill from Dean Preston and the Board of Supervisors. One kind of loss was the $1 billion housing bond, which would have given $300 million to acquisition specifically. So they were looking for that boon, and I think now they're just kind of looking for any place that they can find the money to continue doing their work.
What I loved about the story is that when you interviewed Sandra and Luis and then another tenant in the building, Matthew Suzis, they were all shocked that they were able to get this result, which seems so, I mean, great that it had a happy ending.
I mean, they were. I was asking them, it's like, oh, well, what are you thinking? Like, are you gonna try to own this place? What do you want to do? And they were just like, I just can't believe that we're even talking about this right now. It's like it was too fresh for them. So they really didn't know what was in store for them. I mean, Sandra and Luis are very happy that they're probably going to get a rent decrease. And Matthew is very happy that he doesn't have to move all of his stuff, which I think I kind of alluded to in the story that he has an incredible apartment. I mean, it's one of these places that, like, they talk about the San Francisco being like.
It's like it's the dream apartment. Well, and I mean, and we should add that, Sandra and Luis, I mean, certainly it's great that they have access to this apartment. It's not the biggest room. It's basically, as you said, an alcove studio. So, these stories have happy endings, and yet the situations that our neighbors and friends in this community live in aren't always ideal. But still, it's better than what they had. What a great story.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful, beautiful moment for these guys, and we'll see what the future has in store.
And if people want to learn more about the land trust itself, where could they go to get more information, Aldo?
I mean, look up the San Francisco Land Trust online, sflct.org, and yeah, they have a lot of information there.
Well, if it's good enough for Mackenzie Scott, maybe it's good enough for the rest of us. We're going to leave it here there tonight. Aldo Toledo is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next on on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Assemblymember Mia Bonta from Oakland and journalist Sarah Varney about the future of reproductive access here in California. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Last week, the California legislature held a special session with the stated goal of Trump-proofing California. Topping that list is protecting women's reproductive rights. In 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the federal protection for abortion in its Dobbs decision. Today, 21 states have limited or restricted abortion rights. In California, voters enshrined the right to an abortion in its state constitution, but will that be enough to protect reproductive rights if Trump enacts a national abortion ban? Joining us to talk about exactly what California plans to do to counteract the expected Trump administration changes, we've got Assemblymember Mia Bonta, who represents District 18 in Oakland. Assemblymember Bonta is the chairperson of the Assembly Health Committee, and last week she introduced a package of bills aimed at protecting and possibly expanding reproductive access for women living in the state. Welcome to State of the Bay, Assemblymember Bonta.
Thanks for having me.
Great. We're also joined by Sarah Varney. Varney is the founder and executive producer of Fountain Productions. She served as a special health correspondent for the PBS NewsHour since 2014 and a contributing health reporter for NPR for two decades. Her newspaper and magazine stories have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Guardian, the LA Times, Politico Magazine, and The Caravan. She teaches journalism at Harvard University. And of course, we should mention that her career started here in the Bay Area at KQED. Sarah, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, we want to get you to be part of this next conversation. We're talking about reproductive rights in California under a new Trump administration. Questions to you, listeners, are what plans are you making in advance of possible changes in reproductive rights access? Are you stockpiling birth control? Are you trying to get doctor's appointments for reproductive care before Trump comes to office? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. We're at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Mia Bonta, I wanted to start with you. I mean, we tend to think of California as this blue state, and some people call it a blue bubble, and that it's going to be free from any issues that deal with reproductive access or access to abortions. Is that correct, or is that magical and wishful thinking?
I don't think it's magical and wishful thinking at all. California has some of the most extensive protections in the U.S., with abortion enshrined in our state constitution and nearly 24 pieces of legislation passed since Dobbs to ensure that that protection remains.
And in that, given that we have such strong protections here, where do you see California in terms of trying to broaden reproductive access rights or strengthening them on a national level?
I think California is going to be the tip of the spear, so to speak, in making sure that we continue to be a sanctuary state in providing reproductive care for Californians. We have already seen an increase in the number of people post-Dobbs coming from other states to California to seek care, reproductive care, abortion access, and healthcare access more broadly. And I think that we will continue to play that role while also creating more of the legal framework that will ensure that it continues to be a protected right where it is.
And Sarah Varney, you know, you nearly exclusively, you cover healthcare as a reporter, and your production company, Fountain Productions, is really focused on reproductive access. And you have actually a story from the front lines in California where a woman was denied an emergency abortion. Tell us what happened.
Sure. So this was a woman who was about 15 weeks pregnant and she began hemorrhaging. This was a planned pregnancy. She went to a Catholic-owned hospital in Eureka, Providence St. Joseph Hospital, and they refused to provide emergency abortion care to her. The state later sued the Catholic hospital and they reached an agreement. And St. Joseph's agreed that it would, you know, not do this any longer, that it would provide abortion care. But, you know, this is a real big problem for these Catholic hospitals, not just in California, but in other states. You know, part of their doctrine, their religious doctrine, is that they do not provide abortions. They don't provide vasectomies. They won't do tubal ligations. They generally won't do IUD insertion post-birth. So even in states like California, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, where there are, you know, significant protections for abortion rights, there's still these, you know, pretty large swaths of these states where patients may not get the care that they need.
And is the Catholic hospital allowed to do that? I mean, was it allowed to do that? You're saying that, you know, it came to an agreement that it would no longer do that. But in the instance of this woman who was seeking emergency care, were they within their rights?
Well, there's a federal law that trumps sort of all of this called EMTALA, which is this emergency treatment law, essentially, that requires hospitals to provide care, stabilizing care, even if that includes abortion. And after the Dobbs decision was issued in June of 2022, a few months later, the Biden administration sent out notifications to all the hospitals around the country saying, even if you're in a state where your state has made abortion, you know, a criminal act, you as a hospital must provide this care. Your listeners may remember that Idaho sued the Biden administration over this. It went to the Supreme Court, and it was a bit of a push. So, I mean, essentially, Idaho now has to allow for abortions in emergency situations. But for instance, Texas is not. So the Texas case has not made its way to the Supreme Court. And so in the state of Texas right now, EMTALA is not essentially in effect. So this hospital in Eureka should have offered this if it was necessary to stabilize the patient, which it sounds like it was. But nonetheless, they did not. And so they had to enter into this agreement with the state.
You know, and that I think that brings up an interesting question because, you know, you go to a hospital and you're having a medical emergency. You're not thinking, oh, is this a hospital that's going to ignore my rights or allow my rights to be enacted? So for people, as they start thinking a little bit more proactively about this, Sarah, should they be investigating, you know, what I'm sitting here today, like, should I be looking at my hospital's policies? Do I need to get into the weeds on this in order to make sure that my rights are being protected?
I mean, I would say if you're someone who's pregnant and you are planning on giving birth in a Catholic hospital, it's probably pretty important to have a frank discussion with your physician. I mean, they're probably going to say, well, if you come here on an emergency basis, we for sure will take care of you. But you can look at these, you know, Catholic hospitals in their documents and see their statements about this type of care. And it's pretty clear that they, you know, are opposed to abortion in all circumstances, save, you know, if the pregnant woman is about to die, which is pretty much in keeping with the requirements that come from the Catholic bishops, which is what oversees all these hospitals. So, and a lot of times, you know, I lived in San Francisco for many years, and there was a hospital system there that rebranded itself, and a lot of people didn't have any idea that it was a Catholic hospital. So that may be some place just to start, which is to understand a little bit more about where do you plan on getting your maternity care. Where are you delivering? What are your backups? And just understanding what the limits are of the kind of care you could get there.
Yeah, and it even sounds with even your reproductive care, whether you're a man or a woman, if you can get the things that you need. Mia Bhatta, I wanted to turn to you. You know, it's no surprise that during his campaign, Trump and his surrogates put a national abortion ban on the table. You know, at the same time that his wife Melania Trump was saying she believed in abortion rights. What are your expectations about what the Trump administration may or may not do when it comes to a national abortion ban?
You know, I think that Trump is going to have to thread a very fine needle on this. We know that for the most part, he's waffled on this issue of whether or not he's going to issue a national abortion ban. There are a lot of things that he can do to make it very challenging for us to be able to make sure that we have access to reproductive health care. Take the EMTALA example that you just offered. I actually am introducing a bill, AB 40, that has already been introduced that will clarify that in the state of California, you have to provide access to emergency reproductive health care in hospitals. I think where Trump is going to be able to really create some havoc for us is in the funding of Medicaid and whether or not Californians can rely on our system, Medi-Cal, being able to have the federal resources to provide public health, a public health insurance program for everyone.
Well, tell us, explain that a little bit more to the listeners, for people who may not understand that how Medicare, Medi-Cal kind of work together and what those problems might be.
Yeah, so Medi-Cal is California's public health insurance program. It is essentially funded in large part by federal dollars, $3 of federal funds for every $1 that the state of California distributes go towards Medi-Cal. It supports 14 million Californians who are low income, including children and older adults and people with disabilities. And the federal government has the ability to essentially renew the waivers that we seek that carve out the kinds of medical care that we want to give in any particular state. We have upcoming in 2025 a very significant kind of moment where the federal government can choose not to renew the entirety of our Medicaid funding, which will be very challenging for us in the state of California, where we are certain about our coverage of abortion care, health access. It will put into concern whether or not we will actually be able to, for instance, fund our Planned Parenthood sites, sites that are healthcare access sites that provide reproductive health care. And it will wreak an incredible amount of havoc on us should he be so bold as to not listen to the majority of Californians that know that this kind of reproductive health care is absolutely crucial.
You know, and I think for people who've been following this, what feels just nerve-wracking is, you know, there's stories out there that Trump tried to withhold wildfire monies to California because he felt like, hey, those are not my people. I mean, is there anything that the legislature is talking about? I mean, I alluded to the special session that the legislature had to, quote-unquote, Trump-proof California. I mean, is there anything to be done to prevent what you've just described from happening, Mia Bonta?
I know that our governor has already been fighting to make sure that we can secure the resources that we need to. We have been kind of advance seeking, making sure that we secure those waivers, which we will continue to do. The legislature will continue to pass a series of both legislation and also have conversations around our budget expenditures to be able to make sure that we can afford the full array of supports and healthcare services that are covered under Medi-Cal right now. It's going to be a very big lift, and we're going to have some very difficult budget decisions.
That's for sure. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're talking about reproductive rights in California under a new Trump administration, and we're joined by Assemblymember Mia Bonta, who represents Oakland, and journalist Sarah Varney, the founder and executive producer of Fountain Productions. She serves as a special health correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and a contributing health reporter for NPR. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What plans are you making in advance of Trump's second administration to possible changes in reproductive rights access? Are you stockpiling birth control, trying to get to a doctor's appointment for reproductive care before Trump comes to office? Give us a call. We're at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can find us on social media or email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And Rick from Citrus Heights writes, as a patient in the Department of Ophthalmology at the UCSF Wayne and Gladys Valley Center for Vision, and I'm suffering from both optic nerve hyperplasia and proliferative diabetic retinopathy, I was told that my stem cells are useless solely because of the diabetes. That is even though an ophthalmologist at UCSF did not tell me this. So stem cells from embryos that were aborted could be used to restore my eyesight. And I'm glad that we're going to Trump-proof our policies here in California to help with this. You know, Sarah Varney, when we talk about reproductive access, there's so many other parts of that are implicated, as Rick was saying here, you know, stem cells, for example, or reproductive access to birth control. I mean, are you hearing stories of people who are worried about being able to access IVF or birth control or any other things that are in that reproductive rights universe because Trump is coming to office?
Well, as the assembly member mentioned, she was talking about funding for birth control specifically, and there's a federal program called Title 10. It's a family planning program. It started in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and it was really came out of this war on poverty. And for decades, it has had bipartisan support. That has really splintered in the last decade or so. And when Trump was in office the first time, they changed the regulations in the Title 10 program that basically prohibited any grantee that got this federal funding from referring clients for abortion services. or co-locating a family planning and abortion services. So about a third of all of the sites in this Title X network across the country left this program. This was extremely important. This was about a 60% drop. And there are millions and millions and millions of women who rely on Title X funding for birth control. So this is low cost or no cost birth control. And that affected California as well. And actually, one of the very first organizations that was able to get Title X funding that did not offer the full suite of contraceptive services, which had been a requirement under the Title X program for many years, was actually a Southern California-based company called Obria. They are an anti-abortion, anti-contraception organization. They've opened up clinics across the country. And they, for the very first time, got federal dollars to provide, you know, birth control, but their only form of birth control was the Rhythm Method. Mm. So you can be sure that the Trump administration will do this again in the Title X program. And, you know, this is a way to affect the access to birth control for millions and millions of people.
Wow. We have a listener who writes, I am glad that more women are talking about their health care. I'm always amazed when I watch these legislative hearings about how little lawmakers, mostly men, seem to know about how a woman's body works. I'm reminded of the time that NASA engineers prepping a space mission tried to send up 100 tampons for Sally Ride for a few days in space. You know, Mia Bonta, that is an issue, right? Trying to understand it seems basic. We kind of know the birds and the bees and all that. But a lot of times, you know, lawmakers don't seem to understand how women's bodies work, how menstruation works, or how people actually get pregnant, or what an ectopic pregnancy is, et cetera, et cetera. Are you finding that your lawmakers are getting more up to speed about how women's bodies work? I mean, is that becoming more of a conversational topic or out there than it was when you started your political career?
Well, it certainly is in California, where we are about to reach parity in the legislature, have already done so on the Senate side. So women are now legislating in greater numbers than we ever have been before. So certainly I know how my body works.
Okay.
I think the challenge is that there is, in addition to this kind of legislative challenge, there is this reality that we have entered the manosphere, where that is a thing, where you can have somebody go online and tweet out "your body, my choice" and have that get viewed 90,000 times and reposted 35,000 times. You know, we are dealing in a world where misogyny is fully accepted and appreciated by our president-elect even. So I think part of the challenge is that we as women and people who are have often been othered need to make sure to use the power of our voice and really the power of the influence that we have through legislation, through protest, through standing up, because the reality is that all of those legislators out there who don't know because they don't have a uterus certainly have somebody in their lives who does. Mm-hmm. And we not only need to think about healthcare access around specifically abortion care, but we do need to have a full spectrum of care related to how we consider and support labor and delivery, for instance, or address the impacts of menopause for women as we age. So those are the things that we're talking about now in the legislature. It's the most robust set of conversations we've ever had in California. And I'm really thankful to my fellow women legislators who are doing that work.
Well, I do think that the conversation of abortion, more women talking about the abortions they've had and miscarriages and just their health in more specificity, I think has changed that conversation a lot, especially since Dobbs. Sarah Varney, I want to ask you a different question, which is, we're hearing a lot about sort of maternity health care deserts. You know, California is a state of 38 million residents, and we have, I think, just five licensed birth centers. I mean, that number seems crazy to me. And tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of, you know, is that really a thing? Like, there are deserts where people can't get the maternity care that they need.
Oh, 100%. I mean, and birth centers, of course, are not the same as, you know, hospitals. So myself, like, I gave birth to my son at CPMC in San Francisco. So even though that's not a birth center, it's a hospital. So there is, you know, depending on where you live, there's better access than other places. But we have seen a really across the country, a shuttering of maternal labor and delivery wards. And that's not just in California, it's actually really hit other states as well, much harder. So for instance, in the state of Idaho, they have had several of their maternal, their labor and delivery wards have shuttered. They've lost a number of their maternal fetal medicine specialists because primarily of the abortion ban in the state. But that's true in many states across the country, but particularly where these abortion bans are, it's created a situation where many physicians, I'm sure as many of your listeners know, have made this very difficult choice that, you know, I'm no longer going to practice care in Texas or in Idaho or in Tennessee, and I'm going to move, you know, to a place where I can actually practice. And I, you know, I've spent time in all of those states interviewing those physicians and talking to patients who've run up against these abortion bans and haven't been able to get the care that they need. But it's certainly true that there's a lot of concern in these states that the quality of the care that doctors can give has deteriorated, and that, you know, eventually, particularly as fewer and fewer medical students decide to train in a state like Texas, you know, that you just won't have the same kind of staff there to take care of people who have pregnancy complications. So if you learn how to do a DNC for an abortion, it's the same procedure as for a miscarriage. So if you've never been trained how to do that, what do you do when a woman is coming in and she's hemorrhaging from a miscarriage?
Exactly. I mean, Assemblymember Bonta, I mean, you have introduced a bill to protect the birth centers in California. Can you share more about what that bill would do and why you felt it was important?
This is a very real issue. In the past decade in California, more than 50 labor and delivery wards have closed in California hospitals. And the birth centers that are alternative places outside of the hospital environment that often have better health outcomes for both mother and child have dwindled down from 12 birth centers down to 5. So we have a shortage. I had my first child was born in 6 hours, my second in 3. And you know
wow.
How long my third child took? An hour and a half. And
oh, my goodness.
In the state of California, where you could have to travel up to 2 hours, particularly in the Central Valley, in order to be able to get access to labor and delivery services. So, yes, I have introduced a bill, AB 55. Which is focused on the birth center component of this, which seeks to be able to streamline the licensure process for birth centers so that we can provide higher quality alternative care to more birthing people throughout the state of California by eliminating those the challenges with licensure.
You know, we're coming to the end of this segment, and I wanted to ask this question of both of you. You know, oftentimes, you know, our listeners call in, they feel helpless when they hear about this. And there's certainly a lot of people who feel sort of kind of dysregulated about Trump coming to office. So I wanted to ask what you think the average person can do to ensure reproductive access, not only for themselves, but for the members of their community. What do you think that we should be focused on? And I'm going to start with you, Sarah Varney.
Well, I'll say, I mean, as a journalist, I have a very specific role in all of this, which is to essentially document what's happening. So, you know, my job is to really go around the country and figure out what policies have been implemented and how are they impacting everyday people. So I see my job as just to continue to bring those stories to people. And then it's up to people like the Assemblywoman to decide what to do about that.
And Assemblymember Bonta, you've spoken very openly, candidly about your own experience with getting an abortion. And I wonder again, like, what can an average person do?
I think the average person can do what Sarah is documenting, which is just tell their story, right? At the end of the day, we are the most powerful beings because we have the ability to tell our story around our health journey, around whether or not we've received the care that we so deserve with dignity. And when we are not receiving that care, don't be silent about it. Make sure that you're telling the healthcare provider, make sure you're telling your health plan, make sure you're putting in the time and complaint to be able to make sure your voice is heard, and make sure to call up your legislator and say, this is not right, and you need to do something about it.
Right. Well, we've been talking about access to reproductive care here in California under a second Trump administration. We've been joined by Assemblymember Mia Bonta from Oakland. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing the progress of your proposed bills in Sacramento. And we've also heard from Sarah Varney. She's a healthcare correspondent, the founder of Fountain Productions. She works with PBS NewsHour and NPR and ensures continuous reporting on women's access to reproductive care. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Coming up after the break, high school student Zoe Colley interviews fellow teen Yolanda Renee King. King is the only grandchild of Martin Luther King Jr., and she talks about his legacy of activism and the importance of teens getting involved. More State of the Bay after this break.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear why San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood has high rates of illness.
We all get together and we throw coats up on the barbed wire and we hop over the fence and we'll play in the shipyard. Mud, everything. We didn't know it was nuclear.
Exposed, a documentary from the San Francisco Public Press. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, plus updates from our music hosts and unique stories from the Bay Area that you can only hear on KALW. Visit KALW.org.
Children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I am Zoe Colley, a high school student here in San Francisco. I am so excited to be speaking with Yolanda Renee King, the only grandchild of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. Yolanda is following in the footsteps of her grandparents and is a passionate activist for social justice. And just like me, Yolanda is in high school. I cannot express how excited and grateful I am to have the opportunity to interview Yolanda. Everyone, please give a warm welcome to Yolanda. Yolanda. I know you must get asked this question all the time, but this question was on the top of my list. So I was wondering, do you ever feel pressure to live up to the King name? And how do you handle the expectations from others?
Well, I mean, definitely I will say that the name is just such a big name and a big legacy. And my parents always told me, like, you come from a really special family and a very historical family, but they never forced any of this. None of this was forced upon me. Like, they always told me, look, Yolanda, you don't have to do this. If you have a calling or choose to go in a different path, we will be just as supportive and we will help you and guide you through that as well. And so they never told me that I had to do any of this. Obviously, because the legacy is so big, it's something you can't really deny, but there was never pressure put around me at home. And so I think kind of having that freedom and not being like in a rigid environment, I think that's really why I gravitated towards the work I do.
I love that you wrote a book called We Dream a World, honoring your grandparents and their legacy for activism. In your book, but also in your public speaking, you talk a lot about the power of the youth in any movement for change. What do you think makes the youth voice so important for everyone to hear?
If you look at the demographic of most of the major movements, it's really started and something that is really led by the young people or brought to light by the young people. The civil rights movement, a lot of the people involved were college students. Some were even high school and younger. And for instance, my grandfather, he was only, a lot of people forget, but he was only about 39 when he was assassinated. And so he started when he was in his 20s. He started getting involved in the movement when he was still in his 20s. And so he was a fairly young man when he began. Or even the women's rights movement that was really led by young women, or even just a few years ago with the school shootings in Parkland, that was really something that was led by high school students who were kind of in our age group right now, who really took the lead in this movement. If you always look, the younger generations are always the ones who are doing the movements. And so I think it's so important to even look at that historically. Young people are the ones conducting all the change. And so I think it's so important to get young people involved because they also bring new ideas. I think that young people, and not to say that older people, because obviously I think older people have the experience and the trial and error that we don't have yet. But young people, I feel like, have all the ideas, because I think as kids, it seems like sometimes we learn about this stuff and we learn about the issues of our world, but it's like we're taught, it was kind of nothing that you can do. This is like an adult thing, like let the adults handle it. And then we kind of just have to like sit there like, okay, but like aren't there's still people like suffering or going hungry and all these issues. And it's kind of like through the book, I'm motivating kids. And so really, instead of, not only are kids learning about these issues, but they're learning that, yes, like this is our issues, but if you put in a little work, we can have a different outcome. And it doesn't have to be anything major. You can make your community a little better.
I know that you and your parents are working on a really big initiative called Realizing the Dream. The idea was inspired by your grandfather, Martin Luther King Jr., and his 100th birthday coming up in 5 years. Can you share what Realizing the Dream is about?
So, Realize the Dream is basically a 5-year-long project, and it's a project to, celebrate and pay homage to the work of my family and my grandparents. And basically, the goal is to, by his 100th birthday, so it starts this year, but by 2029, we would have attained 100 million service hours as a 100th birthday gift. And we do this by making service accessible. I think that a lot of times, I mean, service is one of the best ways to really make, like, people are always asking, what can we do? Like, what can young people do? I really think that, like, service is the best and one of the easiest ways that you can make an impact in your community and really if for the long run in the whole entire world. And so I think that by this project, we're going to be able to make service accessible, because a lot of times people don't realize how sometimes people are like, well, yeah, I want to get involved, but like, how do I find service opportunities? And so really just having these opportunities open up, or a lot of times, like if you are someone who's busy or plays a lot of sports or is a lot of commitment, sometimes it's hard to put in the time to do some service. So really working with schools to kind of implement it into their curriculum so that it's not like a whole other something that isn't time consuming, but rather just something that's kind of part of the curriculum, something that's built in. And so really just making these, bringing these service opportunities to light, because that's the best way that we can make a difference. I think that we really need to teach people more about service. And then that's one of the best starting points. And it's something, it's great because it's something that really everyone can do. And also it's so good because it's something that can be diverse. There's not one way to do service. There's not one service project. There's so many ways that you can engage in service in your communities. And so just find an issue you're passionate about, whether that's climate change or working on homelessness. There's just so many things and so many opportunities. And to be honest, personally, my friends and I are talking and we've just done something service related. It's just, there's almost like this reward, like you feel good. You understand that feeling, like where it's like you feel so you did something, like rather than just, even if it's just like what, giving up one Saturday instead of maybe just like sitting down and binge watching your show, you just feel so much more fulfilled by just helping someone or helping a family or the environment. And it's really for the future so that we don't have kids who have to be in the position where they feel unmotivated and have to be told by their adults, let the adults handle this. And you just have to sit there being like, what's going to happen, so that we don't have to go through that again.
I am so excited to be a part of the Youth Council for the Realizing the Dream movement. I was wondering why having middle school and high school students like us be a part of Realizing the Dream movement is so important to you and your family.
Well, this is really like this movement, this project is really for us, because I think we and even those who are going to be coming after us, it's really for the future. And we are, and I know we get told that a lot, we are quite literally the future, because we'll be in 20, 30 years or even 15, or really, this is crazy, but like 5 years from now, we're going to be in the same position as like many of like our adults are in right now. And so really we are the future for this and for this change. And so I think that it's so important that we get involved so that we don't repeat the same mistakes for the future generations and for the future kids.
Okay. Now on a more fun note, I would love to talk about fun things. Do you have a favorite singer or band right now? I personally love listening to SZA. Yeah, I spent a lot of time on Spotify, but I was wondering what artists you like to listen to.
Oh, yes, I listen to too. Love her. Honestly, like a lot of people, I really enjoy, I like The Weeknd, SZA, Frank Ocean is good. Specifically, like old school Frank Ocean. I don't know, I'm getting into a lot of his like old stuff. Like, what is it? Ultra Nostalgia. Kendrick Lamar is also really good. Tyler, the Creator, love him. Except all of them.
Anyways, Yolanda, thank you so much for taking the time to let me interview you. It was so nice getting to know you a little bit, and I think anyone who meets you can say that you are such a role model and someone to look up to. I am super duper excited to be a part of the Realizing the Dream movement and hope others join the movement and volunteer in honor of Martin Luther King Jr.
Thank you for having me on here, and I'm looking forward to working with you on the Youth Council. That should be, we're going to have so much fun.
I want to let everyone listening know that they can go to the website realizingthedream.com and learn more. And please, please, listeners, pick up a copy of Yolanda's book, We Dream a World. It's truly such an amazing book, and the illustrations are so, so beautiful. Yolanda, thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, and I can't wait for our next Youth Council meeting. Everyone, once again, please, please purchase a copy of Yolanda's book, We Dream a World.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll talk about the latest in East Bay politics. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so you'll never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor, the fabulous D Minor, was our board operator. Project 2025 is up next. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.